Okay, well, I don't have the music today. For some reason, I'm having some technical difficulties, so we may actually go long and live on this. And so, welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. My apologies, I made some last-minute changes and didn't understand the ramifications. But again, this show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, and it is also sponsored by MobiusStripPress.com. So if you go to those websites, you will be able to download the podcast and all sorts of content. The number to call in is 215-867-8255. And as you know, this is the only radio show and or content that is actually on the internet and on airwaves that is actually postulating the real solution to how to get the general government back into the box of the Constitution or within the framework. And so if you happen to call in today and you know me, just please be confidential, as always, and please be civil, be concise so that we can get to the point and get through the hour as fast as we possibly can with as much content as we possibly can. I also want to point out the importance of my presentation on reclaimingtherepublic.org. And so I've been directly engaging people, pages, and what have you with Facebook, in getting them exposed to the content and the argument that we need to basically take control. The parents need to step in and take over what the child is doing. And therefore, if you go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and you go to the Take Action page, that is where the video presentation is. It's underneath the slides. I actually have the slides in PDF there as well. But if you click on the link and it'll take you to the Reclaiming the Republic YouTube page, I actually have that video broken down into the three sections that really it is. There's a first presentation, which is less than 30 minutes. Then there's a second presentation, which is about 30 minutes. And then there is probably about 30 minutes worth of questions and answers that I took with the crowd. And actually, that was kind of in between the two. But what we've done is we've broken those things down into three specific segments so that you can actually go and digest them without looking at a whole hour and a half or what have you. Planning on uploading those as well, and I want to get those embedded on the reclaimingtherepublic.org website. So by all means, if you want to help me, by all means, you can always reach out and contact me. My email information is actually on both MobiusStripPress.com as well as reclaimingtherepublic.org. And so moving on, actually, I've been, some people call it baiting. I'm not really trying to bait. What I want to do is I want to have a civil discussion because I don't believe people really understand the framers' paradigm on what religious freedom was back in their time. And I just want to be able to get into, does the Constitution really protect religious freedom, carte blanche? And so I want to kind of throw that out there because most people think it does. And that's why I want to kind of talk about that. I think that people that are Satan worshipers, atheists, or what have you, secularists, Luciferian, all these different religions, they believe that their religion is protected and that those religions can be openly practiced and apostolated and so forth. And I think that's an interesting discussion to have. That's why I'm kind of throwing it out there. So if you want to call in, today would be a great day because it doesn't look like we're going to have any commercial breaks. So I have to explain to my sponsors what ended up happening. So those who may be airing and looking for my hard breaks, I apologize, and we'll have to work this out on the side here. Anyway, let me move on. I hope everybody had an extraordinary Easter. I think it was nice to be able to focus on family, and so that's what I did. And I hope you did the same thing, as well as a spiritual context to that that holiday. For some, it was the Passover, but for most in America, I would say it was the resurrection. And so, anyway, I hope you had a great and a spiritually rewarding and uplifting Easter. The interesting thing before I really get into what the meat of the matter is, and that is the Republic Review, of course. Why wouldn't it be Republic Review? And so the meat of the matter today is that I am in the process of putting these bullets out, and I'm working with a few different people. We're editing, quality control, that type of stuff, making sure that there's no holes, no problems, and that type of thing in what I'm putting out. It's really hard to see your own flaws, your own mistakes. Actually, when I see them, they really jump out at me. But when you're writing, you know, you just think in your head, and so you see your shorthand, and it all spells out perfectly, and you don't recognize that's shorthand. And so what I'm doing is I'm working with a lot of people to get this so we can get this done, because this is a really, really critical election year. We're going to be putting up videos that we're centering towards Utah. We're centering towards Wyoming, South Dakota, Idaho, North Dakota, and Kansas. And that's because these six states have the highest possibility of actually taking on and getting the conversation, whether they flip or whether they at least engage the conversation in the assemblies and in the chambers of the different houses within their bicameral legislative bodies. The point is to get that dialogue injected and get legislators educated on the fact that they have far more power and authority over that Constitution than they are even aware of. And so that's the whole point. And I think there's lots of people that go, well, we got to educate everybody. We got to get this education out there. The effort that it takes to do that will take a long, long time. I always like to use the Moses metaphor when people go, well, you got to get out there and educate people. And then I say, well, how long did it take Moses to change the culture of Israel so that they understood before they could go into the Holy Land how they had to behave and act and so forth? And it took them 40 years. Moses didn't have the entertainment industry. He didn't have the mainstream media piping in propaganda. He didn't have the education system basically brainwashing and indoctrinating the kids into thinking, you know, all the wrong doctrine and ideologies. So he actually had unattested access, and it took him 40 years to change Israel to prepare it to go into the Holy Land. And so what do you think it's going to take to change America? I think it's going to require, I would say it'll require a miracle, but we can't afford to wait. And that's the whole point. I try to talk to people and ask them, what is the brass tacks? How long do you think we have before the next president or Congress decides to discard the Constitution once again? Yes, once again. And what does that mean? Putting it aside. In other words, Lincoln put aside the Constitution, suspended habeas corpus, and was able to incarcerate people. And we already see laws similar to that that McCain was involved in the Armed Forces Appropriations Bill, I think it was 2012, where he basically supported the idea of military and or some types of law enforcement of being able to incarcerate U.S. citizens without a writ of habeas corpus, without, you know, you going through the due process or anything like that. And I'm going, that's not good, folks. That's really bad. And so they're already putting some of those things in place. They haven't done it at wholesale, but they're allowing themselves to put the Constitution aside. And if you can't read the tea leaves, we don't have a lot of time. I actually went out and looked at the demographics of the next 5 years. And if you see how many kids are coming into, you know, coming out of the school system and coming into the political fray, I can tell you that those kids have never participated and never tasted the opportunity of voting. And I'm telling you right now, they are really looking forward to doing just that, voting. And what that means is that I believe these kids are in a position where they are going to have a very high voter turnout because they have been trained and they've been brainwashed into believing that they have the ability to literally step in and take over the political process through democracy and throw the Republic and Republicanism under the bus. They've been trained to do this. I'll ask you to go back to my podcast and go listen to my interview with G. Edward Griffin. And G. Edward Griffin, in the 40s, he felt that he was already in a position that he was trained and indoctrinated into the collectivist socialism type of mind model. I graduated in the 70s, and I really felt as I was getting out of school and, you know, yes, I'm going to be able to vote, and voting for a Democrat is what I was programmed to do. And I'm doggone it, even though my parents wanted to do me to vote the other way, I went that, you know, voted for a Democrat. And so pulling the pin for Carter was kind of a proud moment for me. And then I'll tell you what, I bear the shame to this day that I was manipulated for doing that and not recognizing that. And so those things are actually important. And so what do you do? I will say this, that parents, you better be looking at your kids if they're in the school system and ensuring that you're countering what they are learning, because they are being ramped up to become little communists and literally throwing their liberties back to the state and saying, we can't trust ourselves, you take care of us, because that's the direction they're going. Anyway, I digress, though. Let me get back onto the structure that I wanted to talk about. Before I got into Republic Review, I wanted to talk about Trump suing California on the federal land sales. Isn't that ironic? The statist government of California is becoming so desperate that they're selling federal lands. But here's the irony or the paradox. Those federal lands are actually not federal lands, but those federal lands were taken on the behalf of the, you know, EPA or these green environmental things and so forth. And I'm going, so I don't know what lands they're selling, but the fact that they're stepping in and selling off federal lands, I think, is ironic. But the other side of this is that those federal lands are actually unconstitutional unless they're the port of entries, because the Constitution does give the federal government the ability to control the ports of entries for commerce and people, because they actually do have those controls. It's right there in the Constitution. And it's not just about immigration per se. They're supposed to have the standards of that. But if you go down into the Constitution, I'll actually pull it up, because I find it interesting that most people aren't even aware of that. It's in Article 1, and you'll find it in Section 8. And it talks about the size of the land and so forth. And so it's in 17 to exercise the exclusive legislation for the D.C. proper, which they were supposed to have anyway, which is fine. But if you go through that, it also says, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state, in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. And so those ports of entry are part of that. And you'll actually find that they're not buying these lands. They're actually only leasing for the military side. But they're saying right here in the Constitution that they're supposed to purchase by the consent of. So in other words, for them to actually own that land, they have to actually pay for it, but they never did. If you look at all of the land that the federal government occupies, they're either leasing on the military side, and some of these EPAs, they were strictly Caesars. They did not go in and purchase that land for the needful purposes, and they have to be within these enumerated powers. They can't just purchase land and say for these spotted owls or for these hopping fleas and that kangaroo fleas or what have you. That's not constitutional. So the fact that the federal government is actually buying land that, or not buying land, seizing land and or suing the state for selling supposedly federal land, which is unconstitutional, is the paradox that I'm throwing out here for you. That being said, let's try to focus today on the fix to the problem. The problem, first off, we have to agree that the federal government is well outside the boundaries of the Constitution. And so if it is well outside the boundaries to the Constitution, then my position would be this, that if the Constitution enumerated the need for the federal government to manage all energy, back in those days, the federal government then would have regulated coal, maybe oil, you know, like whale oil, and what they use for energy, wood, and those types of things, to say we need to basically control the cutting down of trees, the mining of those things, and enumerated that power within the Constitution, but they didn't. And so in energy, there is nothing within the Constitution that gives them the power to regulate energy and to set standards or create a strategy, like Jimmy Carter tried to do in the 70s when he erected the Department of Energy. It is an unconstitutional power. So as I have said, and let me just jump down to all these different departments, because it's important that you understand which of these departments and how they are, or how I should say they affect us. The Department of Interior, they're the ones that kind of control all the federal land, especially in the western side. They are the tyrannical enforcement in the states. It was under the Department of Interior that Lavoie Finicum was murdered. The Department of Justice is another one. Department of Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, Transportation, Energy, Education, Veterans Affairs, yes, Veterans Affairs, and Homeland Security. So you'll find that none of those departments were defined within the Constitution, allowing them to regulate or create any type of governance over those affairs. Those affairs were left to the states, and they were specifically left to the states. And so too many people think that the federal government has the ability to do anything it wants to do. And no, the Constitution limits it to the very specific roles, responsibilities, and powers within the Constitution. So those listening to this program, and who have been listening to this program since the beginning, they should know that we are limited to the defined roles, responsibilities, and powers within the Constitution. And with that, I will also say that there are amendments to the Constitution that could grant the federal government powers. And when, and as those who've listened to the show, I've actually talked about this, that when the Congress wanted to create the first attempt that Congress wanted to create the Department of Transportation, they went to James Madison and said, here's a bill we'd like you to sign, and what it's going to do is kind of create the framework for a Department of Transportation. Well, he vetoed it in 1817, and he vetoed it because those powers weren't within the confines of those enumerated powers. And he says, these are clearly unenumerated powers you're asking for, and the only way that we can exercise these powers is for the states to delegate that power to us. because we are limited by those things that are within, are the enumerated powers within the Constitution, and we can't perform anything outside of that. And so what he did was he vetoed it, sent it back, and that's probably the reason why the father of the Constitution does not have a real monument, because he kind of stuck it and poked the eye of Congress when they tried to usurp that power. They didn't appreciate that. That was his last act as president, by the way. And so you probably all know that. So how do we fix this problem? Now, do we fix this problem through the court system? Can we actually go out to the court, and can we actually count on the judges to rule in favor of the Constitution and the Republic? Well, nine times out of 10, it's never done that. And even more importantly, I've actually come out and said that if you look at the powers within the Constitution itself, the federal court does not have jurisdiction over the Constitution. And, or I should say, let me correct that. They only have jurisdiction over what is within the Constitution or what's within the ratified treaties. They don't have jurisdiction over the many things that are outside of the Constitution, if this makes sense. And such as healthcare, such as education, such as energy, and all of those things. So the fact that they get involved in any of those types of issues and any of those types of concerns is actually unconstitutional, if that makes sense. And so what I would recommend is if you look at the different powers that are within the Constitution, then you look at what the government is doing outside of that, then you'll come to the conclusion that there's absolutely no way that the federal government is going to be able to sit, or I should say the Supreme Court is actually going to be able to sit over the states in reviewing the Constitution. In other words, this is not a court that has the authority over those things that the states are actually going to pursue and go after in republic review. And this is why the states actually have to assert their authority over the contract. And so getting this into that context is what republic review is about. But before I do that, let's eliminate these other possibilities of fixing this problem. So the court system can't fix this problem. They just don't have the jurisdiction over all of these things that the federal government is usurping. Now, I will say that they have injected themselves into this. The Supreme Court is equally culpable and responsible for usurping these powers. But it's not alone just them. Congress and the president over the past 200 years has been doing this. And so to get them back into this, how do we fix this? Well, some people say, well, let's use the election process. So let's go to the party and let's get our party in there. Now, we've been doing this for 200 years, and the definition of insanity by many would be doing the same thing over and over and what? Doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results. And so if you're with me on this, you probably have reached that point of insanity of going, why do we keep electing just these rhinos or these Republicans? Especially, we know what we get with the Democrats. They're going to continually take our liberties away because they're socialists and they are statist. They don't believe you can be trusted. They don't believe you can govern yourself. And they want to centralize all power. That's what they've been doing. And that's a part of the progressive movement that is well entrenched within the Democrats. And it's also entrenched within the Republicans. And that's why we haven't even changed. So the election process is a part of the problem as well. And so what do we do if we can't use the election process and the Supreme Court? Well, I would recommend that people start getting involved in taking the party back and what we have to do, because we're going to have to rely on the party, even though we've been advised not to. we're going to have to rely on the party for some form of standards, because how else are we going to actually be able to get moving forward without having some type of organization setting standards, and that the party is what brings in that organization? I wish we could come up with another way, but there really is no other way. I mean, I liked William F. Buckley's solution. His solution was you could just take any phone book of any metropolitan area, just open it up and randomly select a name out of there. And he says you'd probably find a better person in a random selection than you could with the people that seek power, because those people who seek power are seeking it for very personal and selfish reasons. But anyway, we can take the party back, but the only way we can do that, and the way we can do that that is best for our posterity, is centering the party and its platform and vetting process on the Constitution. And so using the Constitution as our weapon and our shield is essential, and integrating that into the party, especially when we're going to be going up against the statist progressive communist, because they have a process of incrementally taking, and they never give back. If they've given back prayer in school, even though it's been proven that since we've stopped prayer in school, stopped teaching the Bible and those types of things, that we've created an immoral nation. And that's why there's just so much crime and so many problems of addiction and mass shootings. All of these things are an indictment towards the immorality of our nation. When you have a good moral nation, and the framers all talked about this, that's the only way you can self-govern properly is through a good moral nation. Anyway, so we have to use the Constitution in taking the party back, but that's going to take a long time, and that's the process of Moses. It'll take a long time to change the culture through the party process. Well, there's some groups out there that are calling for the Article 5 Convention. And the Article 5 Convention is what I would just basically say is your, help me out here. It is your nuclear option, and it is only good if, one, you want to actually make a change or delegate a new power, or three, if you literally want to make a wholesale change of our government, and just like what they ended up doing. And that's one of the biggest concerns that a lot of groups have, is that the Article 5 process is a process that possibly can be taken over by progressives and get rid of the Constitution and get rid of the Republican forms of government and republicanism, and push us into a pure democracy. And if we go into a pure democracy, the empirical data out there is that we will ebb and flow back and forth between tyranny and anarchy, so that we will have moments of absolute chaos, because we will make changes that will just throw the baby out with the bathwater. Then next thing you know, we have a despot that will rise and literally, crush us with all sorts of oppression. And then we'll end up having to fight again, a revolution. And I've told people this, that we really don't have the technology in our advantage anymore. Things are not the same as they were back in the days of the British Empire. A musket was a musket, and there was limited technology. A ragtag colony could put up against an empire was pretty interesting, because they were able to actually win battles and actually win the war, even without all the big funding and all the production and everything else that Britain was able to do. But that's when things were equal. Today, there is so much technology and so much capabilities that the government has that just a small little resistance force, there's just no way you can do this. I'm sorry. I I don't want to say that you can't be a resistance. You know, you can go live in the woods, but there's no way you can engage and try to take back our government. They have the ability to reach across the world with laser precision and actually, you know, take you out just like that. And if that's not overwhelming, then people need to really think about that again, because when you're considered the threat, I just go to Ruby Ridge, go to Waco. There's lots of people that are upset about it, but not enough. And as a matter of fact, I will tell you that as time passes on, more and more people are being indoctrinated to think, yeah, those people had it coming. And that is what really scares me. And that's what really bothers me. So the Article 5 process, back to that, it is incapable of actually fixing the problem. And even more importantly, it does not have I believe the credibility that people can really trust it in actually just doing the amendments or what have you. There's just too many players that I just think that we have a lot of us have big reservations regarding. I mean, the Article 5 process is within the Constitution and it is a mechanism for making a change. But again, there's just no credibility within the players that want to do this, whether we can trust them in complying to what they say they're going to do or not. So what or how else can we get the general government to comply to the Constitution? And again, I've actually read this. I've read what Jefferson and Madison did in 1798. These are the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. And what were those? The Kentucky and Virginia resolutions were when Jefferson and Madison responded to the federal government violating the First Amendment. That's all they did, was they basically said, hey, you can't say certain things about the people in power. So they started regulating language. And kind of like the very first attempt of political correctness, so to speak, within the Republic. And so if you think about that, then I think you can start, you know, garnering that that was just a small spot compared to what we're dealing with today. I mean, we're already dealing with political correctness, but we're dealing with all those 12 departments that I read through earlier. And those are all problematic because they're creating regulations, policies that are driving our prices up, making us spend more money. They're using these things to control us. Because if you look at energy, why does the average household spend so much money on energy? Well, because you have available disposable income. And as that changes, they want to be able to ensure that you do not have too much disposable income in the average household so they can constrain you. I truly believe that, I won't even get into that. What I will get into is I'll get into the bullets of Republic Review, because until you can prove otherwise, and I've talked to Dr. Vile, I've talked to a lot of other people. Everybody that I've talked to, not one has been able to say, well, that's unconstitutional. You can't do that. And so until somebody can actually say otherwise, then I believe that is the only mechanism that we have at our disposal to get the federal government back into compliance to the Constitution. And so let me walk through this with you. And this is what I call the irrefutable argument for Republic Review. And so per Article 7 of the Constitution is a contract. And so it doesn't say anywhere in the Constitution that it is a contract, right? Nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Constitution is a contract. However, if you read Article 7, and I will pull that up for you, and it's pretty simple. Let me go to the Constitution. It's a single liner, folks, and it says, the ratification of the conventions of 9 states shall be sufficient for the establishment of this constitution between the states so ratify the same. Okay, so what does that line say? Well, it's calling for the ratification of this constitution, but it's saying that it has to be done by not state legislatures, but by conventions of 9 states. So there's the parameter. They needed to have 9 states buy into the constitution. And they had to ratify that. So what does ratification mean? Well, it means the same thing today as it did then. It is a formal process of accepting a contract. And so the question is, when the states went through the ratification process, was it a binary process? In other words, yes or no, vote. Let's get all these convention delegates together and we will vote on whether we're going to accept the Constitution or not. Well, that's not what they did. And as a matter of fact, there was a lot of ruckus because they saw this new constitution as creating a big monster. And so the states actually had these conventions where they sent a whole bunch of anti-constitution, and what most people would call the anti-federalists, into these debates. And they had the delegates who actually wrote the constitution to testify, as well as other federalists who were supporting the Constitution, who testified. And in this process, they were basically stipulating, defining, and elucidating this contract. So whenever that is done, my friends, if you're making a contract with your landscaper, contractor, whomever that's coming in, and you basically say, this means this and this means that, and they agree upon that, if you're defining something that's within that contract, whether you do it in writing or if you just do it verbally in an email or in a phone message or a text, that is legally binding to that contract. And so the ratification debates, my friends, are actually legally binding documents to the Constitution. And so, again, the Article 7 portion of the Constitution, even though it may be simple, this is where the power rests. And it points specifically to the power of the Constitution rests with the states. So it stipulates that, one, this Constitution is a contract, and it stipulates to whom this contract is to. And four, it is to and for the states. So the stakeholders of the contract who have to buy into this were the states, not the federal government. This contract actually created, and it is the charter for the federal government to go off and do specific things. And so that's probably where I believe people can use that, because I believe the republic itself, once it became the full sovereign, once you had a majority of the republic that empowered the creation of the federal government, then therein lies, my friends, the vehicle for the federal government to actually start functioning within the powers delegated to it. And so if you're fathoming that, then the states actually have reserved to themselves all powers that were not delegated within that constitution, which means, yes, energy, education, health and human services, housing, all of those powers that were not delegated within this constitution are actually reserved by the states. You get it? So if the federal government is exercising state powers and the states are the stakeholders of this contract, then clearly the federal government is the subcontractor and the states do have the authority within contract law over this constitution. So again, back to the bullets, line one, or the issue one, or bullet one, per Article 7, the Constitution is a contract. You cannot refute that. As a matter of fact, all the framers called it a contract, and I just went through it. And in Article 7 and in Article 5, per the principal stakeholders of this contract, they are the ones that possess the ultimate authority over the contract. If you look at Article 5 is the amendment process, and it identifies how a constitutional amendment is ratified. And the ratification process grants the power, the ultimate power, the final say over whether that amendment is going to become constitutional or not and become enforced would be the states. In other words, the states have the ultimate authority over any type of changes to this contract. So they are the sovereigns over the contract and over all things not delegated to the subcontractor or to the federal government. Isn't that interesting? So bullet one, the Constitution is a contract, bullet two, per Article 7 and 5, the states are the principal stakeholders of this contract and possess the ultimate say over that contract. So bullet three, per the 9th and 10th Amendments, the states are sovereign over all things not delegated to the federal government within that contract. If you go and read those two amendments, this is all the reserve powers that are retained, or I should say they don't even list them. What they say is those things that are not delegated to the federal government are retained by the states. They didn't need to use the word exclusive. They didn't need to use anything. The fact of the matter is if it's not delegated to the federal government, it remains in the state and or the collective states' power to be able to do what they need for those roles, responsibilities, and powers. And so if you look at the Department of Transportation, because that's not delegated, that's something that the states need to be working out and working on a process of establishing highways, roads, and airports and all those types of things. Now, keep in mind with an airport, if that airport is servicing traffic that actually brings in cargo or people that are coming from another nation, then the federal government does have the responsibility of making sure that the said cargo and people are within the confines that the federal government has controls over. Well, you know, are they duly passported? Do they have the permission to come in here? Is the commerce something that is because they have the ability to regulate foreign commerce, not commerce amongst the states, but they do have the ability to regulate and tax foreign commerce. And that's what they did in the very beginning. So accordingly, let me get into this 9th and 10th Amendment. Accordingly, the states delegated specific and limited roles, responsibilities, and powers within the contract or within the Constitution to the general government and were constrained per the contract from doing anything that was not specifically delegated. So go again and read the 9th and 10th Amendment. The fourth point in this argument, or the irrefutable argument for Republic Review, the only way the general government can constitutionally obtain a new role, responsibility, or power is to request the states to delegate this desired role, responsibility, and power to them, the general government, per an amendment to the Constitution via the Article 5 process. So if you look at those 12 departments that I listed, energy, education, and so forth, if there is no amendment to the Constitution delegating them that power, here's a good one for you. A lot of people look at civil rights and the Civil Rights Act as a constitutional thing. The ADA as a constitutional thing. And so I'm going to pull up the Constitution again, and I invite you to look at this said Constitution, and you tell me out of the amendments, because there's all these different amendments. The 11th was the judicial power construed. The 12th was the manner of choosing the president. In other words, they amended the Constitution for the electoral process because they had problems with it. And so to change that minute thing about the Constitution, they actually amended it. So that proves that that's the only way you can make these types of changes. And then moving forward, they abolished slavery in Article 13 or the 13th Amendment. 14th Amendment were the citizens' rights not to be abridged in due process and so forth. The 15th Amendment raised no bar to voting rights. In other words, basically, they were handing out voting rights to more people, and ensuring that race was not a bar, actually, so that anybody, they would not allow states, with this amendment, they did not allow states to basically bar any specific race from being able to vote. The 16th Amendment was the authority for income tax. 17th Amendment was changing the senators. Liquor prohibition was the 18th. The 19th was giving nationwide suffrage to women. So now, no, you know, both sexes were able to vote in the federal elections. And the terms of the president and vice president were redefined in the 20th Amendment. The repeal of the 18th Amendment, so now people could drink and produce liquor again. The limiting of the presidential terms of office was in the 22nd Amendment. The 23rd was the presidential vote for the District of Columbia, allowing those people to have that level of representation. And then the 24th was barring poll tax in federal elections, because for centuries they used to use poll tax, and some people started using that as a weapon. The presidential disability and secession. So if something happens to the president in the 25th Amendment, or he's incapable, they can use this amendment to basically hand the presidency over to the vice president. The 26th Amendment was lowering the voting age to 18, and the 27th Amendment was the Congressional Pay Amendment that passed, because I call that the Hillary Clinton Amendment, because it was actually proposed way back in 1791, and it was finally ratified in 2000, or whenever she became the senator for New York. My point is, folks, not one of those amendments created the ADA. Not one of those amendments created the Civil Rights Acts and equal employment opportunity and all these other things. My point is that what we consider constitutional rights are clearly only those things delegated to the federal government, and none of those have been delegated either. And so what they're doing, and what the federal government is doing by creating quotas or whatever it is that they're doing, they are exercising tyrannical powers, because they're arbitrary and unconstitutional, because the only way that the federal government is able to actually exercise, I would call it a constitutional power, is for them to actually have that power delegated to them. If that makes sense. And so moving on, and I wanted to go through that because I wanted to prove that point, that when people consider the ADA and some of these other things as constitutional, I'm here to tell you that we didn't give them those powers. Those are powers that they just created, these acts, just like the Sedition Act, and usurped the state's ability in granting themselves. The federal government granting themselves these powers. So anyway, going back to the point that brought this up, the only way the general government can constitutionally obtain a new RRP is to request the states to delegate the desired RRP roles, responsibilities, and powers to the general government per an amendment to the Constitution. Again, see Article 5, because that is the constitutional process of being able to delegate powers to the federal government. Bullet 5. And we're only going to get through a few of these because I really want to highlight these and talk about these and walk through these. Why? Because it's that critical. It's critical that you understand the really the hard defined limits of the federal government within the Constitution, and getting them back into these confinements is where we need to get if we want to save our republic. Because if you don't recognize this fervor and this this communism that is coming down the pike with these kids wanting to take our guns away and everything else, if you're not reading the tea leaves, it's very critical and very important that we start getting together and exercising constitutionality within these election processes. We want to make sure that our next electors are becoming more and more constitutional, understanding their responsibility within this. And so I actually got less than 5 minutes left, and I keep on forgetting to tell you it's 215-TOP-TALK if you want to call in. Anyway, number five, the General Welfare and Defense Commerce Clause, the Necessary and Proper, these are the clauses, the Necessary and Proper Clause and the Supremacy Clauses are not ambiguous portals for the general government to assume new roles, responsibilities, and powers, and that these clauses only apply to the enumerated roles, responsibilities, and powers within the Constitution. So that supremacy clause doesn't mean the government is supreme over what it thinks it is. It's only supreme over those few enumerated powers within the Constitution. And as a matter of fact, it's the same thing with the necessary and proper. They can only apply the necessary and proper clause to those things within the Constitution. The Commerce Clause are those fine things, or defined things within the Constitution that they are able to exercise. In other words, the importing of goods going out and constraining foreign trade, that type of stuff. They do not have the ability to regulate to the nth degree as we understand, because the word regulate at their point in time and in their reference was to make sure it was in good order. The Commerce Clause was literally given to the federal government to ensure that one state could not take an economic advantage over other states. Case in point, New York and Virginia were the two main ports of entry into the states, and actually Massachusetts was another. So because these few states had ports of entry, and Ohio and Kentucky and Tennessee and so forth, they didn't have these types of ports. States could not tax goods coming in that were being transported into these other states. They couldn't put an additional levy or fee on those goods. Only the federal government could actually tax those things. And so the Commerce Clause was to make sure that some states couldn't take advantage of other states. And it had to ensure that there was a uniform application of these types of standards or these commerce regulations, or I should say the flow of commerce. Again, you couldn't have taxes of things coming in, nor could you have taxes of things coming out. And therefore, there had to be some form of mechanism for the ports to be able to make their money without taxing those types of goods and so forth inordinately. And another good example would be getting states to basically say, well, we're the only ones that produce a certain food that's really necessary, whether that be beef or what have you, corn or what have you, and be putting the rest of the republic into a bind of basically saying, hey, you have to pay extra for these types of products. And that's exactly what the South was undergoing leading into the Civil War, was the northern states were putting tariffs, and they were violating that uniformity clause, and they were violating the Commerce Clause by putting those extra burdens onto the South. And so with that, I actually see that I am coming up on the end of the show. And so this is the first time I've actually had this kind of technical difficulty, and I apologize. I will have this fixed tomorrow. And I want you to know that we will get back into bullets 5, 6, 7. So I'm highlighting these so that we can actually get into these tomorrow. because I want you to understand these are very, very important. And so with that, I will kind of let things fly. And see, I can manually put a song up, but anyway, I want you to know this is G.R. Mobley. This is Reclaiming the Republic. And if you're back with me tomorrow, we will get more into Republic Review and how together we can reclaim the Republic. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.